Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, women's voices on culture, style, society and well-being. Radio Gorgeous, where women do the talking.
So I'm here again with Jen Levine and talking about your fantastic life and career. Tell me about your life, you know, sort of your early life, because you were evacuated during the war.
I was born in 1939 in Hampstead Garden suburb in a field. I mean, it was all fields at that time. It wasn't built up as obviously it is today. And that was 1939, beginning of the war. And then my father was called up into the Home Guard in Hertfordshire, in a place called Little Gaddesden. And my mother grabbed me as a tiny child, baby, and my sister, who was 2 years older than me, Sally, and off we went to Little Gaddesden, where there was a, I can't remember exactly, but a small, like a little farmhouse, and at the back of the garden there were chicken pens and things like that. It was very rural. And I always remember my mother collecting the eggs. And it was wartime, so we, in a way we were very lucky to grow our own produce and have eggs. My memory goes back to the bombing and rushing to the little shelter which we built. We huddled up together, my mother, my sister, and myself and a little dog called Betsy. Aww. And we all huddled up together, and I always remember this Mickey Mouse gas mask that I wore. And that's the extent of my memory as a little child.
Yeah. And so, but your mother had a dress shop in Knightsbridge, so had she, did that close up during that time?
No. Mummy went from Hertfordshire to London. And she and her mother, my grandmother, and her brother, Wilfred, ran this little, well, it was a little dress shop, right next door to the French Embassy on the main street in Knightsbridge. It was called Gertrude Carroll, opposite Harvey Nichols.
Yeah.
And that actually survived and thrived during the war years. My mother was there from the age of 17 till she was 75.
Wow. I imagine she was quite an energetic woman. So we're going to, you know, keeping chickens and growing vegetables and two small children and running into town and out of town and dressing ladies in waiting and coming and going. Yes. So I guess you didn't really have a choice, and which is why, you know, this day you're as busy as you are.
Yes, right? That's right. In the genes, as they say.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And so at some point, in Boots or something, you pick up a Kodak Instamatic.
At some point, oh my goodness, you do ask difficult questions. yes, I picked up an Instamatic camera, I suppose in my late teens, and fiddled around and did what we all did, which was snap whatever we wanted to, without anything in mind that it should be any deeper than that. And then I love nature and love colours and I love flowers, so I went into the parks in London and photographed each season as it came and painted, started to paint actually in watercolour from the photographs. I used to pin up a photograph on the wall and have an easel there and with watercolour started painting. And somebody quite locally in Marylebone who had a little gallery happened to see these photographs and the odd watercolours that I had done. And she said, well, shall we do an exhibition? And that was really the beginning.
Yeah, sure, why not?
Yes, she did this exhibition, and it was one wall of photographs and the other wall opposite of the watercolours. But interestingly enough, she sold the watercolours, but not the, but not the photographs.
Funny.
Well,
yeah,
that's
knows?
The way it was.
Yeah, and it strikes me that sort of kismet, that these sort of wonderful, lucky opportunities that have come up. But you seize them.
I do. When as I look back, and I still do to this day, an opportunity arises, and I think very quickly, can I use this? And I do.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if that's what you call chutzpah.
Yes, exactly. Seizing those, is it having the courage of your convictions,
yes,
and seizing those moments. Yes, yes, I would consider that's part of the same, yeah, as part of the same picture. So then another lovely opportunity comes up. Someone asked you to photograph covers of books.
Book jackets. Yes. I met a friend at an ordinary dinner party, nothing special, and his name, Jeremy Robson, and he was an up-and-coming young publisher who had a one-room office in Poland Street off Oxford Street, way down somewhere. And I went to see him. He was quite interested in me because I'd been chatting at the dinner party about using my camera and photographing and loving it. And he said to me, look, let's try this. So he said, I'll tell you what, I need jacket covers, photographs for my books. And it'd be nice if you could photograph the personality, such as it was Alfred Brendel, Claudio Arrow from the music world, and the King Singers and the Goons. So when he said the Goons, you know, I thought, gosh, I'm going to meet Peter Sellers, which I did.
Yes.
So I went with Jeremy to the pub. It was a Grafton pub in the city somewhere. And Spike Milligan and Harry Secombe and Peter Sellers, they were all there drinking in the pub. And I was absolutely in awe of all of this. Yeah. And they were so nice to me. And then we went outside from the pub and I took a few photographs, which appear in my new book, in Just One More. And that excited me so much that I thought, gosh, I must go on with this. Mm-hmm. And Jeremy then asked me to photograph Robert Morley and actually the future Prime Minister of Israel, Yitzhak Rabin, who I met later on. So I did all of this and loved every moment. And I didn't get paid, but he allowed me to keep the negatives and the contacts, and I could do what I liked with them. So it was, you know, not being a professional photographer at that time, just being an amateur, it was a fantastic idea.
Yes. And how did you... I guess that gave you more confidence in your photography, because you were being taken, you know, something you just, you know, showing off at a dinner party, and then it's, oh gosh, I have a job. Like, okay.
Yes, it did. It boosted my confidence enormously. And I had a publishing party recently, and I asked Jeremy Robson, hadn't seen him for a long time. And there he was, how many years older? Like 40 years older. And he was standing right in front of me when I was making my speech. And I thanked him publicly and told the guests what I've just told you. Yeah. And everybody applauded Jeremy. Aww. It was so nice.
That's so nice to have that circularity,
yes,
in your life. And how did you come to meet Henry Moore?
I wrote a letter to him, mm-hmm, and a letter of admiration, saying I loved his work, and I heard that people were coming down to see his grounds and his studios with different groups, and I wondered if I could come along and meet him one afternoon. And I got a telephone call back, which surprised me, and a voice said, "Hello, Jem Levine." Yes, Henry Moore here. And I thought, because I told everybody, it was one of my friends. So I said, oh, come on, was my response. And then there was dead silence. Henry Moore here.
They were like, sorry.
Yeah. Anyway, to cut a long story short, he invited me down to meet him. And I took my Instamatic and I started photographing everything I saw. And had a wonderful hour. Not that I had very much conversation with him, because he was busy showing some Americans some sculpture that had just come over, especially, and so on. But what he did show me was really the start of my work with him, which was just an ordinary elm bark laying on the ground, on the grass, and with his stick he pointed to it. I've got a photograph of him pointing to the bark in the book, I think. And he said, in 2 years' time, Gemma Levine, this will be a reclining figure to celebrate my 80th birthday. So I couldn't believe that, or not believe it, but I couldn't understand it. So I questioned him and said, how will the general public know that you carve from an ordinary bark of wood and then finish up by this
tree trunk,
extraordinary, incredible reclining figure that you're so well known for? So he said, well, with your camera, come and see, you know, how it's done. And that was the beginning of my life with Henry Moore. Mm.
To me, those photographs, because you worked with him for, I think, 12 years until his death.
Yes.
And you were always Gemma Levine. Mm-hmm. One word.
Yes, until the end, when I became Gemma, the last meeting.
Yeah. Very touching. Could you tell us of your last meeting?
Well, it was some 10 years later, and I'd stopped doing books with him, and he was very, very ill, and he was dying. And I went down to see him quite regularly, maybe every second or third week. And then the last time I went, excuse me, which was the last time I saw him, he was lying in bed in his living room downstairs, he loved to look at his garden, overlooking the gardens and huge picture windows. And there he was, very frail, covered up with blankets, propped up by pillows, in his pajamas. And I noticed how pale and how thin he was. And I also noticed that all the years I knew him, he had very piercing, alert blue eyes. And that day, his eyes were standing out of his face. They were so enlarged. And I was distraught at seeing him like this, and I knew instinctively that this would be the last time. Anyway, I sat on the floor next to him, and he put his arm out to hold my hand. And he said how much he enjoyed being with me all the years, and he called me Gemma. And if I'm not careful, I'm going to burst out crying on radio, so let's stop there.
Yeah. What occurred to me in your photographs with Henry Moore, it was a perfect marriage, because as you said, you started out taking pictures of nature and photographing his stuff in situ, which seems to me is so much how he saw it.
He did.
As part
yes.
of the yes. a part of the landscape.
Yes. Yes, very much. That was what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
Was to show his work with the dimensions of space.
Yeah.
And landscape. And sky was very important.
Yeah, and you instinctively got that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, even your photographs of his hands have a sort of landscape quality, I would say.
So?
I would say so. You know, they look like they're not dissimilar to your pictures of the Sinai Desert. You know what I mean? In that sculptural, you know, landscape
form.
Yeah. Those.
It's so interesting because I've never thought of it like that. But thank you for that thought.
And so then it occurred to me, how did you go from being really sort of, you know, so and more, I wouldn't say a landscape photographer, but a sort of, you weren't doing portraits, and then you were doing portraits. how did you turn into...
Well, I don't know. You see, I started off, should we say, with the Henry Moore books. Mm. They weren't portraits as such. They were capturing moments and progress of the work, and also all the tools and things like that that he used. So it was quite a varied array of photographs, including some portraits of him, of course, many, and his assistants and people that he worked with. So portraits wasn't too far from the scene when I went on to my Famous Faces in the UK. And then I had a studio, which I hadn't had before. And I was able to have a room where I could put a backdrop, which, was, by the way, was always absolutely plain, no pattern at all, just plain black or plain white background. And I had a sitting chair for the sitter, and that's and my cameras and my lights at the back, and that was it. And then I all I wanted to do was photograph faces, people.
Yeah.
And catch whatever I could of their personalities.
And at one point, I imagine you switched from having a Kodak Instamatic to Hasselblad. A little bit different.
Yes, that was from the kindness of my former husband.
Yeah.
He bought me a Hasselblad and for my birthday, and I was absolutely astounded. And from then on, I learned how to use it. And
you don't go back to Kodak Instamatics after that.
No, I don't. But I've used it all my working career until I got cancer, and now I can't lift it. And I wouldn't anyway, because it's not digital, and it's too much of a performance now to start taking black and white film and going to laboratories and having them developed. And I mean, it's a whole new world, as we all know.
Yeah. I remember my father had turned one of my sister's... a closet in my sister's room into a dark room because it had no windows, and I remember going in there and having to thread the you know, film through and spooling it through in the dark. And
it was quite difficult, actually.
Yeah.
And you had to really watch what you were doing. And now, it's a click of a button, that's all it is.
Yeah, and kids are like, let me see it. You know what I mean? We used to wait, you know, you take pictures and you'd wait weeks, you know, until your parents got around to dropping it off, getting it developed, and then, you know, and then you'd only see a contact sheet, and, you know.
It's but, quite different. Yeah. Anyway, I loved what I did. It was amazing, my career.
RadioGorgeous.com.
And how did you first go to Israel and photograph Yitzhak Rabin?
Well, I met the publisher George Weidenfeld, and who's still today thriving with his publishing company, Weidenfeld, and he asked me if he could see my portfolio of photographs. I went to see him. And I had some changing seasons of my pretty little pictures of parks in London, and suggested that maybe Laurie Lee, the great poet, would write a few words and accompany my photographs. And he looked very irritated and said, absolutely not, that's a ridiculous idea. So I was put in my place immediately. And he said, have you got anything else? So I had some photographs of Moshe Dayan that I'd taken a month prior, that I wheedled my way in with Chutzpah to meet him. And those photographs, George Weidenfeld was terribly impressed with and said, right. He said, I'm about to do a book with Moshe Dayan called Living with the Bible, and I need a fresh eye to do the photographs. How do you feel about it? Boom, there you go.
Great. I feel great. And at that time... in your marriage, your husband, you had two small sons, and your husband was very supportive of your work.
So we discussed it, obviously, and I decided that if I went 2 weeks in the spring, 2 weeks in the summer, 2 weeks in the autumn, and 2 weeks in the winter, it wouldn't be disruptive to collecting the boys from school and so on and so forth. You know, it wasn't too much. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't actually 2 weeks, it was less. It was like a week, just over a week, four times in the year. And that worked out perfectly.
Nice. And during one of those trips, you were in the desert on your own overnight.
Yes. I had an appointment to meet a general of Peru who was... supposed to collect me from the airport in Sinai, and he was supposed to take me to the Wadis to photograph them for Moshe Dayan's book, Living with the Bible, and he didn't show up. So it just so happened that an Australian guy in a jeep turned up at the airport for whatever reason, I don't know, and he spoke English, of course, so I spoke to him and said, I don't know what I'm going to do. Have you got a... In those days, they didn't have a mobile phones, but they had walkie-talkies. And he got through to Peru's office to find out what had happened. And apparently Peru had the next day written down in his diary. So what was I going to do? Because there were no planes going out. It was a tiny airport. So this Australian man took me to right into the desert in his jeep to a medical hut where he said Peru was going to collect me like 24 hours later. That was the arrangement. So this man said, just stay here and here's some fruit and here's some tomatoes and there's a bottle of water and you'll find a blanket inside the medical hut. And I'll see you tomorrow at 5 a.m. So I had a whole day on my own in the desert. I saw a couple of Bedouins and maybe one or two camels, and about that was it. And heard lots of unfamiliar noises in the middle of the night. And I became very disturbed. Mm. And it gave me time to reflect on myself and my life, which I did. So I titled that chapter Atonement, because for me that was like a day of atonement.
Yeah, amazing. And so then, but then you were asked to do the portrait. Well, you didn't know at the time it was going to be picked as the official portrait, but of Princess Diana, and it's a very famous photograph now. And tell us how that came about.
Well, I first of all, I did a book called Faces of the 80s for leukemia, a charity, Leukemia, the Sharon Allen. And when that was finished, it was quite successful. So a friend of mine said that he was in touch with the Malcolm Sargent Cancer Research. And what about doing a book of the 90s for them? So I said, it sounds wonderful, let's talk about it. So he introduced me to Sylvia Darley, who was the chairman of the society. And she said that Princess Diana was her patron. And would I photograph Princess Diana so that we could have a foreword by Princess Diana at the front of the book. And then the book would be Faces of the 90s, which it was. So I met her immediately through the Malcolm Sargent Cancer Charity.
And she has, in that portrait, it has everything, you know, that we, the adoring public, loved about her. You know, to me, that portrait is emblematic of her being the people's princess. There's something very accessible, very warm.
Yes.
And very, it's relaxed.
Yes.
You know, in your company, I think that comes through.
Once we met, I remember the first day she came into my studio. It was quite a long corridor from the front door to my flat door, from the front door of the building, and I pressed the entry bell, and she didn't walk through. She ran. She ran through, and she was obviously very happy. She was obviously in a very good mood. And she burst into my room and, you know, gave me a kiss on both cheeks. And we'd never met before. Well, that's a lie, because I met her the day before in a lift in Harvey Nichols, but she didn't know who I was. And I knew who she was. But anyway, that was our first meeting, and we got on instantly.
Yeah.
And she allowed me to choose what she should wear. And I asked her very nicely if she would remove all her jewellery, because I wanted simplicity. Mm. And I chose the outfit that she wore for that. It was a picture of her official photograph of the year. So it was a black halter neck and very simple. So that was good. And then she said, would I like to do some more photographs? And I said, yes. So she said, well, I've got my changes here. Would you mind if I changed in front of you? I said, not at all. You know, we were like best buddies in half an hour.
It's so funny because I didn't realize when you say it, of course, it's obvious that she's not wearing any jewelry in that photograph. But that was very powerful statement, because it always in with royals, that's, you know, that's what you're looking for. You're looking for the sparkles.
Yeah.
Wow. And it's her that sparkles out of that photograph because of that. Yeah.
I think it's all there.
Yeah. And you became quite friendly.
Yes, she invited me to lunch at Kensington Palace, which was a big thing for me. Mm. I had to buy a new outfit. And it was...
Your mother must have been so proud.
Yes, but my mother always liked me wearing dresses, and I hated dresses. So I think she was cross I went and bought a trouser suit for Mamani. Very cross.
And then you did a lot of... What was the book that had... It was portraits of all the people in the theatre.
That was one, I must say, one of my favourite books. It is called Faces of British Theatre.
Yeah.
And I had met Jonathan Miller before then and told him I wanted to do this. So he agreed to do the foreword for me and help me with the... I was going to say guest list, not... with the list of... sitters from theatre, and I showed him my list, and he, you know, I had all the obvious people like Judy Dench and Bob Hoskins, who I'm terribly sorry to hear he had died today or yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he said, well, there are more people in theatre than just your people you've listed. What about the backroom ladies that do the dresses and gowns and makeup and scenery and technicians? And he was absolutely right. So he supplied me with a much more detailed list, an accurate list of people of British theatre. And then I asked John Gielgud if he would also help, and he wrote in his own hand, which I have framed on the wall, he wrote the introduction of the book, which is absolutely marvellous.
Lovely.
So, and then I wanted a large format book with photographs on one page and very small captions on the adjoining page, which I had, and the captions were Jonathan Miller's. So it's absolutely super book.
Mm, it's lovely.
And Prince Edward opened the launch at the National Theatre of my exhibition of that book.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it was terrific.
One of the portraits, I don't know if it's in that book, but of the actor Peter Bowles.
Yes.
And he grabbed your camera and then took a picture of you.
Yes, because he said, is there a photograph of you in this book? I think it's People of the 90s. And I said, no, there isn't. So he said, well, it has to be. So I said, well, no one's going to take one. So he grabbed my camera. We were sitting in the garden having a cup of tea, and he took one photograph, and I liked it so much.
It's a lovely photograph, very glamorous, you know? And Sir John Gielgud enjoyed his sitting for you so much and described it as such a tranquil experience. And he suggested to Peggy Ashcroft.
Yes, he went to the telephone in my studio and said, do you mind if I make a call? And I heard him say, Peggy, darling... in that wonderful voice that he had. You must be photographed by Gemma Levine. She's very calm and it's very peaceful here, and you will love it. And it won't take long, but you must be in the book. And she agreed. So I made an appointment with her, and she came.
And at that point, despite, you know, for whatever other reasons, your marriage had broken down.
Yeah.
And you hadn't seen your in-laws because of that.
For 2 years, yeah.
Yeah.
And while I was photographing Peggy, in fact, I just about finished, I certainly got what I wanted, the doorbell went, and I didn't have anybody to, any help at home. I mean, it was just me, so I had to answer it. So I said to Peggy, would you mind if I answer the door? So she said, not at all. And she was sitting there, very happy in her seat. And I answered the door, and in came my former father-in-law, who I was very fond of. And he came in, and he lives or lived in Brighton. So it was quite a journey for him to come on the train, an old man. And he came in and threw his arms around me and said, why is it that we haven't spoken to you or seen you in all this time, and don't forget you were part of our lives, all of this sort of thing. And he started crying and I burst out crying and completely and utterly forgot Peggy Ashford was sitting there. It just went.
Yeah.
So, arms around each other, Danny and myself, she puts her head round the door, and then I realised, really, she saw what was happening, so she came up and she put her arms around both of us, and she said, I overheard, and I really do understand what you're going through. It's happened to me in my life, and I'm going to leave you now and let the two of you have a reunion.
Mm. But not exactly the peaceful, tranquil scene that Sir John Gielgud had described.
Yes, she did ring up the next day and said that she rang John to tell him it wasn't quite so peaceful as he had indicated.
However enjoyable nonetheless.
She said she'd never forget it in her life.
There you go. Yes. An unforgettable experience, yes. Courtesy of Gemma Levine.
Yes.
I think you've given that to a lot of people. And again, not always in good circumstances, because as you alluded to before, you had a very aggressive form of breast cancer.
Yeah.
And even through that, you seem to have been thinking about other people. And again, like the theater experience, all the people who are sort of behind the scenes, not just the oncologists and the surgeons. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, while I was sitting in the chemo chair for many, many months, I was thinking, how could I describe this experience to others in a positive way? And then I had the thought of inviting all these different characters to write a chapter, for example, the oncologists, the nurses, obviously the surgeon, and then I thought of losing one's hair. So I invited the people that make the cold cap. The cold cap is like a helmet that you put on your head for a period of 2 hours, 8 degrees below zero.
Ow.
Yes. And that in order for you to keep your hair.
Wow.
And I thought that was absolutely amazing, and I went to meet them. I did some research, and I went to their factory and watched how they worked and photographed. And all of a sudden, I had a book almost there, almost ready, and I asked people like Miriam Stoppard to write about the media vis-a-vis cancer, because I'm sure we all know you pick up a paper and they tell you not to have this, not to have that, not to treat this, not to, if you want to avoid cancer. And then another paper will say, have this, have that, the same things to avoid it. So I asked Miriam to write an article on a chapter on that. And then I went to a bra shop to find out about mastectomy bras and got somebody to write a chapter on that. And all different areas dealing with cancer, which has made the book. And I had a very good, I wrote my own introduction forward. And then I thought a very good idea. I wrote off to people like Boris Johnson, the Mayor of London, and Joanna Lumley, and Judy Dench, and John Major, and William Hague, and all sorts of people that I'd photographed, to ask whether they would write 3 or 4 lines at the head of each chapter of a positive thought of going through cancer. And that book, called Go With the Flow, is a bestseller, unfortunately.
Yes. Well, but they say, you know, to get to survive cancer, you either need a very positive outlook or be cantankerous. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, you are emblematic of having a very positive outlook. And you also asked Samantha Cameron to write a few words.
The Camerons, yes. I wrote to... I didn't write to the Prime Minister because I thought that was really not right. Why should he spend the time...
He's busy.
Yes, got other things on his mind. But I thought, why shouldn't I write to Samantha, which I did. And I got back a note from her PA saying that she really didn't have the time, she was so involved. And I wrote again and said, well, maybe her PA could write for her and whatever, whatever. And pursued that, my corner.
Yes, exactly.
And then I got an absolutely wonderful note back to say she really couldn't do this, but she'd be very happy for me to choose my favourite charity and give a party for this purpose, for the charity. And since I did the whole book for the Maggie's Cancer Care Centre, I thought that was wonderful. So we had a party and at 10 Downing Street, and I got my oncologist to speak.
Fantastic.
And it was fun, and Samantha spoke about the charity, and the charity people spoke. It was fantastic.
Great result. Better than three lines.
Exactly.
What could be
exactly.
Better? Gemma Levine, Gemma, thank you so much.
It was such a pleasure.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us, contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com, and to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox. Who can think of anything better, darling?